Who is William Mariner? What is a Tokiukamea? What language am I even speaking, and what is this podcast about? We are going to answer those questions and more. Hello and maloi lele. My name is Richard Wolfgram. I am your host, and welcome to the podcast Tokiukamea, the story of William Mariner. Let's start the show. The story takes place in the island kingdom of Tonga, and I'm aware that some of you may not know where that is, so let's do a quick geography lesson. The kingdom of Tonga is located in the South Pacific, and it is neighbors with Samoa, American Samoa, Fiji, New Zealand. Population's about 100,000 or a little bit over 100,000. There's a huge Tongan diaspora throughout the globe, in New Zealand, in Australia, in some of the Asian countries, also in Europe, and also here in the United States. Tonga is a constitutional monarchy, and recently experimenting with democracy. And let's just say that is a work in progress. Okay, but there was one event that put Tonga in everybody's radar. The Rio Games of 2016. So during the Parade of Nations, it was time for Tonga to come out of the tunnel. Notice how it's very quiet.
Atlanta 20 years ago.
But then the crowd just goes crazy. And in the stadium Jumbotron, we are introduced for the first time to Pita Taufotofua, the hunky Tongan flag bearer. And then he goes viral, and he's on every TV show, and he's on the Today Show. And the thirsty women on the Today Show are like rubbing him down with oil and drinking champagne and loving every minute of it. And Pita's looking very nervous. And then Al Roker butchers his name.
Tatatafua. Mom, Pita. I'm going to go with Pita. Crowd erupts when you walk in. How did that feel?
It was crazy. I mean, it was 20 years worth of work to get me there, but...
He didn't win any medals. But what Pita did is, you can't deny it. Everyone pretty much knows about Tonga now. Yay, Peter! Yay! Okay, so one more thing I need to get out of the way. You might hear me say Tonga. You might hear me say Tonga. Both mean the same thing. In Tonga, we actually say Tonga with a heavier T. So don't be confused. I'm just talking about the same thing, and I use it interchangeably sometimes. And my connection to all of this, well, despite my very white passing name, I am Tongan. My parents are from Tonga. I used to live in Tonga when I was younger. My father is from Vava'u, from the villages of Koloa and Ha'alaufuli. And then my mother is also, her mom is from Vava'u, the village of Mataika. And then her father is from Fatai, Tongatapu. And then we just have connections to a lot of villages, to Ha'ano and Ha'apai, to Vaini in Tongatapu, and I'm sure there's more. And that's just how things are when you're Tongan. You are practically related to everybody. The story of William Mariner is such a fascinating one because it's only one of the few records that we have of pre-Christian Tonga. And also just the fact that here is this kid, 15 years old. He's from London, England, and he ended up in Tonga and was living in Tonga from 1806 to 1810. And so how did he get to Tonga, and why is a 15-year-old traveling without his parents? And where the hell are his parents? Were they even looking for him? We have so many questions. And the only way we know about this is because Mariner had his experiences documented in a book. And so that book is the source material for this podcast. And if you want to follow along, I highly recommend that you go to Amazon and look up William Mariner's Account, Volumes 1 and 2. I believe the publisher is not printing anymore, so the book is out of circulation, but there are many used copies online. So on August 8, 2012, a local man by the name of Tevita Moala discovers a shipwreck just off the coast of Foa Ha'apai. And in the background, you are actually hearing footage of scuba divers that are examining the shipwreck. The ship had some unique characteristics, like it had an anchor that was typical of European ships in the 18th century. It also had copper sheathing on the hull, and that is also typical of ships from the 18th century. I had to look this up. So they used to apply sheets of copper to the hull of ships to protect them from things like sea worms, from barnacles, and also from the corrosive effects of salt water. And some of the copper from the ship was taken to be examined. The Greenwich Maritime Museum and the Marine Archaeological Society concluded that this is most likely the remains of the Port-au-Prince. And this was exciting news for Tonga, for Tonga's tourism, for Tongan historians, for academics, because the Port-au-Prince has an intrinsic connection to Tonga's history and also to William Mariner. So here we have this ship all the way from Europe sitting in the bottom of the ocean, and it's all the way in Tonga on the other side of the planet. And I think for us to really understand how the Port-au-Prince got to Tonga, we really need to look at what was happening in the world during that time. So at that time, it was the turn of the century, and the world was transitioning from the 1700s into the 1800s. And this also marked the tail end of the Age of Discovery. The Age of Discovery, if you remember back to your public education, this is when we learned about these European nations that are going out and exploring the world and quote unquote discovering these new lands, making claims to them, even though there were people who were already living there and civilizations that were established there and have been there for thousands of years. And so we're moving out of the Age of Discovery and into the Industrial Revolution. And the Industrial Revolution is one of those moments in history that we like to celebrate, right? Because this marks the beginning of modern civilization and human progress. We start to see the beginning of urban sprawl, and so a lot of people were moving from villages into these urban centers to work in factories. But the Industrial Revolution had a dark side. It was a real shitty time for indigenous people, for Africans, for people of color. And so after the Age of Discovery and these European nations had their little colonies all over the world, and then they stripped them bare of all their natural resources and sent them back to their countries to develop their own economies and their own wealth. England had its colonies here in the New World, and the 13 colonies successfully fought for independence in 1776 and became the United States of America. And they were the newest actor on the world stage and joining all these other European countries in colonizing other parts of the world. And also, it was kind of like a race to the top. So we have all these empires and all their colonies, and they are trying to build their nations. But here's the thing. You have all these natural resources, but you don't have the laborers and you don't have the manpower to move it. So what do you do? Well, history answers that question, because this is when we see the rise of the slave trade. And really, slavery has been around for a long time in the history of mankind. But this is when we first start to see slavery being institutionalized. And so the Port-au-Prince was right in the thick of it. We actually don't know the original name of the Port-au-Prince, but we know from records that it was built in 1790 in France, and it was owned by the French government, and it was captured by the British in 1793 off the coast of Port-au-Prince, Haiti, and so that's how it got the name. And at this time, England and France were at war. And like good capitalists, and you know, everything's about the bottom line, they kept records, and there is a database of slave voyages from England that indicate that the Port-au-Prince was transporting slaves in 1796 from the west coast of Africa to the British colony of Guyana in South America. In 1797, we see that the Port-au-Prince transported more slaves from Bonny Island off the coast of Nigeria to Guyana, South America again. The Port-au-Prince transported 359 slaves and landed 328 slaves that were alive for a loss record of 8.6% according to this database. And the fact that they track these kind of numbers just shows you that the slave trade now was all motivated by profit. The last time the Port-au-Prince transported slaves was in 1804, and the record showed that it transported slaves from Nigeria to Kingston, Jamaica. In 1805, the Port-au-Prince had a new owner, a London shipping magnate by the name of Robert Bent. The Port-au-Prince was recommissioned and it was no longer transporting slaves. And now it was hunting whales in the Pacific. But the Port-au-Prince was also a privateer and it was authorized to engage in warfare. Spain had a large presence in South America, and so the Port-au-Prince was commissioned to raid these Spanish ships. Basically anything that belonged to the Spanish, whether they were ships or towns, they were supposed to raid it, pillage it. The goal was to slow down Spain's economic activity in South America. The Port-au-Prince had a crew of 85 men, 28 cannons, and they were pretty good at what they were commissioned to do. And they partnered up with another ship called the Lucy. The Lucy was also a privateer owned by Robert Bent. And together they were successful in raiding coastal colonial towns owned by the Spanish from Chile all the way up to Mexico. This reminds me of just one of my favorite video games. It's called Assassin's Creed 4 Black Flag. And oh, I love that game. I imagine the world at that time was like that. Eventually, the Lucy and the Port-au-Prince split their loot and they parted ways. I don't know where the Lucy went to, but the Port-au-Prince remained in the Pacific Ocean and it continued to hunt whales. And it looks like it raided a couple more Spanish ships. And it made a stop in Cedros Island, just off the coast of Baja California in Mexico, on the 1st of August in 1806. And unfortunately, the captain, Captain Duck, fell ill and he passed away. And so he is buried there in Cedros Island. Now, the next captain was a man by the name of William Brown. And apparently the crew didn't respect him the same way they respected Captain Duck. Just a very different style of leadership, and really, if he was more like Captain Duck, we probably wouldn't have the Port-au-Prince at the bottom of the ocean today. So imagine you're the master whaler, and now you are the captain. You have a crew that doesn't respect you, you have a ship that is falling apart. The new captain just had a lot of challenges. The Port-au-Prince did some island hopping in the area, and it departed Guadalupe Island on September 19th of 1806. And on the 28th of September, the Port-au-Prince landed in Hawaii. On its way to Hawaii, the ship was taking in 17 feet of water every 24 hours. And Captain Brown was very worried about the state of the ship, and so he devised a plan to get the Port-au-Prince to England for repairs. So the plan was to provision in Hawaii, take the Port-au-Prince to Tahiti, and then from Tahiti they would go to Australia, and then from Australia to England. Now in Hawaii at the turn of the century, Kamehameha was still working on uniting the islands. The Great Mahele hasn't happened yet, and Russians, Chinese, Japanese, they were all arriving in Hawaii at this time because of the lucrative sandalwood trade. Horses were just being introduced to Hawaii, and the estimated population of Hawaii at this time was 265,000 people. And here in the USA, our nation doubled in size because of the Louisiana Purchase, and we purchased all that land for a mere $15 million. Yes, you heard that correctly, $15 million. So with Captain Brown at the helm, the Port-au-Prince made several stops in Hawaii. The first stop was in the Big Island at Kawaihae Bay. Kawaihae Bay is where Kamehameha confirmed his position as the Ali'i Nui of all of Hawaii. Kawaihae Bay was also a popular stopover for European ships to repair and to resupply their ships. And Kamehameha was able to become the Ali'i Nui and unite all of Hawaii because he leveraged his power and authority to trade with the European ships that were coming into Kawaihae Bay. According to the document, A Cultural History of Three Traditional Hawaiian Sites on the West Coast of Hawaii Island, it says, because King Kamehameha firmly controlled all trade and other intercourse with Euro-American ships, all sea captains arriving in the Hawaiian Islands had to obtain his permission before initiating any activities with his subjects. Therefore, ships were constantly stopping at Kawaihae to pay their respects and gain his blessing when he was in residence. Okay, so my Hawaiian friends, I'm going to need your help on this one. On October 9th, the Port-au-Prince attempted to dock as what is referred to in the book as Anahulu Bay. And I went on Google Maps just to look up and see where that's at in Oahu. And I don't see any bays that are named Anahulu Bay, but I did see an Anahulu River in the North Shore, and it empties into Waialua Bay in Hale'iwa. So if any of you know, please hit me up. Interesting to note that when the Port-au-Prince arrived at this bay, they were denied permission to come on land by the local chief because there was rumor of a sick crewman. And apparently, before the Port-au-Prince got there, there was an American ship that introduced an illness to the Hawaiian natives. And so, of course, naturally, they were worried. And for a good reason, the crewmen on the Port-au-Prince later died. The Port-au-Prince drifted around the Oahu area until they were able to provision before their trip to Tahiti. And so they took with them food like pig, chicken, plantain, sweet potatoes, and taro, and also 8 crewmen from Hawaii. And on their way to Tahiti, the leaks were coming back. And every half hour, the ship was taking in water at the rate of 9 inches per half hour. And to make things even worse, the pumps stopped working. Some of the cannons were taken off and thrown overboard, and this thing called a triwork. So remember, the Port-au-Prince was also a whaling ship, and the triwork was a brick stove that was used to boil down the whale fat for oil. And this was also thrown overboard. And so in this madness, and they're trying to make sure that their ship doesn't sink, the Port-au-Prince completely missed Tahiti, and they ended up further west in the South Pacific. On November 27th, 1806, the Port-au-Prince arrived in the waters of Ha'apai Tonga. On Saturday, November 29th at 4 p.m., the Port-au-Prince anchored in Lifuka, Ha'apai. And Lifuka was probably familiar to the Port-au-Prince because this is where Captain Cook anchored in 1785. And so later that evening, Tongan natives came aboard the Port-au-Prince with a puakatunu, which is a roast pig, and a type of yam that in Tonga we call them ufi. In Tongan culture, there is a hierarchy to our foods. And so to special guests, a roast pig and yams is like the best thing that you can offer. And amongst the Tongan natives was a translator who was actually a Hawaiian man. And he had learned English on an American ship that took him from Hawaii to Manila, Philippines. And they had dropped him off in Tonga. And he is referred to in the book as Tui Tui. When Captain Cook was in Tonga, he had named Tonga the Friendly Islands based on his experiences with the Tongan people. And he was there for 3 months. And so I'm sure the reputation of Tonga was familiar to the crew and to the captain of the Port-au-Prince. Now here's a good time to introduce William Mariner. During the Revolutionary War, Mariner's father, Magnus, commanded an armed merchant ship and fought under Lord Cornwallis. Now we all know how that went down, and England lost the Revolutionary War, and Magnus lost his wealth, and he abandoned seafaring and settled down with his wife, and eventually they had children, one of them being William Mariner. In school, Mariner was an exceptional student. He did well in geography and history, he knew French, he spoke a little Latin, and when he was 13, he became a clerk to Captain Duck on the Port-au-Prince. Captain Duck and Mariner's father were acquaintances. Apparently, Captain Duck served under him during the Revolutionary War. And he was the one who asked Mariner's parents if he could take him on as a clerk. And so, this is how he ended up on the Port-au-Prince in Tonga. So let's do a little backtracking. When the Port-au-Prince was raiding the Spanish colonial towns along the coast of Peru, the churches were no exception. In the Ilo district, they pillaged the valuables of a Catholic church, and they took silver candlesticks, chalices, incense pans, crucifixes, and then they burnt the entire town to the ground. In the Callao district of Peru, they attempted to do the same thing, but this was prevented by rough seas. As the Port-au-Prince ventured up north on the South American coast, it made a stop in the Talara province of Peru. This was when Captain Duck was still alive, and Captain Duck and a few of his crewmen were granted an audience with the governor of the Talara province. Now previously, Captain Duck gave a relative of the governor a ride from Atacames, Ecuador. So the governor didn't forget this kind gesture and reciprocated with supplies and food, in addition to the visit to the governor's house. So Captain Duck and his officers were being entertained by the governor. His daughter, just 16 years old, slightly older than Mariner, had just returned home from school at a Catholic nunnery. She knew of the Port-au-Prince and what it did in the Ilo district, and she also knew of the attack that was planned for the nunnery at Callao. During this encounter, she was visibly horrified and agitated, and along with Captain Duck and his entourage was William Mariner, who was only 14 years old at the time, and the governor's daughter knew enough English to interrogate him. She asked him directly, "Were you involved in the pillaging of the church in Ilo?" Mariner tells her yes, but all he did was knock down the images, so maybe statues or maybe artwork that was on the wall, perhaps. "Okay, Mariner, you did, you little bastard. I'm gonna say that counts as pillaging." And so she looked at him and said, "Your ship will not return to England, and you will never again see your mother and father. And the ship and all the crew will be destroyed as a just judgment from God for the heinous sacrilege you committed." Damn! Damn, girl! Okay, so back to the ship. So the Port-au-Prince arrived in Tonga, they're in Hapai, they're in Lifuka, they are in, you know, the Friendly Islands, and they are greeted warmly with a roast pig and with yams. Everyone is happy and content. But remember the 8 Hawaiian crewmen that they picked up when they were in Hawaii? They were just being haters, and they were like, "Hell no, we don't want your roast pigs and your yams." And they were telling Captain Brown, "Do not trust these Tongans." And they felt like these Tongans had hostile intentions. Captain Brown chose to ignore this advice, and this would turn out to be a costly mistake. So the next day, it was a Sunday, and Captain Brown ordered his crew to careen the ship. So careening is the practice of grounding a sailing vessel at high tide in order to expose one side of its hull for maintenance and repairs below the waterline when the tide goes out. Thank you, Wikipedia. However, his crew didn't feel like careening a damn thing, because on Sundays, it was custom that wherever they anchor, they are allowed to go on shore, and it's kind of like taking a day off. Dude, I totally get that. If that's what we do on Sundays, then damn it, why are we working? I get it. But here's the other thing. It didn't help that the crewmen were enticed by the locals to come ashore. Now, in Tonga, we have this skill called whakahekeheke. And if there's a people who are extremely gifted at this skill of enticing others against their better judgment, it is the Tongans. And I am telling you this from experience. I've been a victim of some of y'all's whakahekeheke many times. So I get this too. So you have a crew, you know, it's Sunday, should be their day off. And then you have these locals that are just sweet talking them and trying to get them to come ashore. Red flags everywhere, right? And so this made Captain Brown even more angry. His ship is falling apart, his crew is being belligerent and challenging his authority. The locals are trying to entice them to come ashore. And one crew member by the name of James Kelly, he drew a Spanish stiletto. Okay, now this isn't a shoe with a sharp heel. This is a pointed dagger for stabbing. And then he swore, "By God, I will run the first bastard through the body who attempted to stop him." And so he called an Uber. The canoe came and picked him up. Three others were like, hell yeah, I'm going with him. And then 15 others grabbed their belongings and also went ashore. Do we all see where this is heading? Ha ha! Red flags everywhere? The remaining crew continued to work on the ship, but then they noticed something odd. The Tongans are starting to board the ship, but this time, not with a roast pig and not with yams, but they were coming with their clubs and their spears. Meanwhile, Captain Brown, a chief by the name of Vakautapola, and another chief who's not identified by name in the book, and a crewman by the name of Mr. Dixon and Mariner were in the cabin having a meeting. And during this meeting, Mariner left the cabin towards the steerage, and he encountered some of the crewmen who were coming down to the captain to let him know of what was going on the deck. And then Captain Brown was just like, yeah, okay. And Mariner had to actually go on deck and look into it and then come and confirm to Captain Brown that that's exactly what was going on. There were Tongans on deck and they all had their clubs and their spears on hand. And then Captain Brown was like, oh, okay, maybe I should look into this. And so he led Vakautapola by hand and they went up to the deck and everyone else in the cabin followed. And Mariner noticed that Vakautapola looked at the other chief and they turned pale and they were agitated. So now they're all on deck and Captain Brown ordered that the weapons and people be removed from the ship. So they started to throw their weapons overboard, but Mariner noted something odd. The best clubs were carefully passed from one person to the next and then placed carefully into the canoes. And to show that he's a good sport and to promote peace between the two groups, Captain Brown ordered that their own arms, their muskets, their pikes, their axes be removed below. Why, Captain Brown? Why? And then later that evening, all the Tongans left the ship and they went ashore, so nothing happened. And several of the crew member had advised Captain Brown to bring the muskets back up and place some crewmen on deck to patrol. And Captain Brown was like, oh, that's a great idea. Yeah, let's do that. Actually, he didn't. He did not even do it. Captain Brown, what is wrong with you? So the next morning, December 1st of 1806, the Tongans were back. And they boarded the ship early at about 8 in the morning. And eventually, there was about 300 on the ship. Around 9 a.m., Tui Tui, so you remember the Hawaiian native that had been living in Tonga for a while and knew a little English, he came on board and he invited the captain to go on a walking tour. And of course, the captain said no, right? Because he has to be with his ship, right? No, Captain Brown was like, okay, let's go. And before he leaves, his crew's like telling him to arm himself. And he's like, nah, I don't need that. Ugh. Captain Brown, why are you like this? Meanwhile, Mariner is working in the steerage. And then he's coming out of the steerage and he looked up and he sees Mr. Dixon. And remember Mr. Dixon from the day before. And he's trying to prevent more natives from coming on board. Suddenly, Mariner hears a loud shout. And then a club just smashes Dixon in the head. And Mr. Dixon is dead. What will happen with William Mariner? And what happened to Captain Brown? What happened to the crew on the deck? And what happened to the other crewmen who left the ship to hang out with the locals? Tune in next week to find out. Thank you all for listening to the first episode of the Toki Ukamea podcast. Please subscribe and share this podcast to all your family and friends. I will be updating the podcast weekly. And if you have any questions, feel free to leave me a voicemail on our Anchor page or send me an email to rwolfgram, rwolf, as in Frank, gramm@gmail.com.